Hello, I'm Michael Polignano. I'm here with my colleague from Countercurrents, John Morgan.
Hello.
And our guest today is Ferenc Almasi. He is the independent journalist and the editor-in-chief of the Visegrad Post. Welcome, Ferenc.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your work with the Visegrad Post.
Well, that's a 2-year-old project. It started in late March 2016. I have conservative views, and I was thinking that there was, and there is still actually, a lack of information about Central Europe, about the Balkans from a conservative point of view. There is no objective journalism. I mean, everyone writing, everyone analyzing political facts, political moves, is necessarily having bias, having a specific point of view. It's not a problem, because we have freedom of speech and freedom of opinion, so it's not a problem. The problem is when you don't have a journalism which is representative of the people's opinion, and most of the people in Central Europe are, let's say, do have conservative point of views. But still, most of the media are, let's say, left-wing or liberals. So I thought it will be useful to have a news portal. It's not much about, by the way, it's not much about news, but rather about analysis. So we try to do interviews and to write some explanations about what is happening in Central Europe and from a conservative point of view. So it's a little project. We are a really small team. Actually, I'm the only one working on it. I mean, it's my job, but other people might help me sometimes. So we are not producing a lot of content, but we try to do as much original content as we can and also provide our readers with conservative analysis and also interviews. We will have in few time some improvements. It will be much more interesting within a few months.
Mm. Let me just say, because I imagine most of the people listening to this will be Americans who might not be familiar with the name of your publication, of the site,
yeah,
what it represents. So there is this group, the Visegrad 4, which consists of Hungary, Poland, Czech Republic, and Slovakia. And I guess it's about 25 years old now. It emerged shortly after communism ended in Central Europe.
Yeah, exactly. 26 years. Actually, the Visegrad group. So this is where comes the name Visegrad Post. The Visegrad group is named after a city, a town which is now in Hungary. In the Middle Ages, it was a royal capital from all these countries. I mean, of course, it was not Czechia and Slovakia back in the Middle Ages. But the different kingdoms back in this time were once one kingdom under the rule of one king, and they were living in prosperity and peacefully back in the 14th century. And at this time, the capital was the town of Visegrad. So in 1991, after the fall of communism, the leaders of these countries, once again, back in this time, in 1991, it was only 3 countries because Czechia and Slovakia were at this time Czechoslovakia. So the 3 leaders of this country decided to bring up an informal working group, an international cooperation. Officially, its purpose was to make it possible for these countries to integrate the European Union and NATO. But it appears that from the beginning, they had in mind also the possibility for this region to dispose of some structure which might help them in case of common problem. Mm-hmm. And that happened 2 years ago with the starting of the Balkan migrant crisis. And at this time, we could say the Visegrad group has been reactivated. And since then, it's really useful for these countries and it's strengthening a lot.
And they've really taken the lead over the last 2 years in resisting the EU's immigration policies in relation to the migrant crisis, which is basically an open-door policy, whereas Orban and Poland, in particular, I know, have been resisting and calling for reform. Of course, the most famous example is Hungary's border fence with Serbia. I'm sure everyone's familiar with
that. Yeah, which has been protected and which is still protected by V4 squads. Mm-hmm. So these countries have organized themselves their own protection and resistance. Since the EU was not stepping in this case, there were just talks in Brussels. So these countries decided to act quickly. And they did not just secure their Hungarian southern border. They also gave help to Croatia, Slovenia, Serbia, Macedonia. And they are pushing for 2 years now, they're pushing the whole EU in a more responsible position toward migration. Because it's a fact that, I mean, even if you are willing, for example, like the Soros network, even if you're willing to let in 1 million migrants per year in Europe, which is not a speculation, it's what they claim, it's what they want,
yes,
openly. So even if you do, you want that, you have to organize it. And you cannot let in people illegally. It's not an option for a normal state.
They're not even required to show any kind of ID. So
yeah,
they can claim that, oh, I'm a Syrian refugee, when actually the person's from anywhere in the Middle East.
Yes. And the authorities have to believe them,
yes,
even if it's obviously a lie. So these states, these Visegrad states, decided to speak with one voice in order to have, a greater strength within the EU, because they had to face Germany, which is obviously the head of the EU and the real master of the EU right now, actually. So by gathering their forces, they were able to impose another point of view in the EU, and they became like spin doctors, you know, for many people within the EU. And after 2 years of this crazy migration policy, many countries start to, even Germany, start to face the problem. And of course, they don't want to recognize their huge mistake, but they start to find other solutions, even if it's a bit late for the best case. And the Visegrad group now, for example, they were the first one to propose to have hotspots in Northern Africa. And they were the first one to offer some help for the Libyan Coast Guard, for example. So this is just a logical, human, and responsible way to respond to this migration crisis. It's just the first step, because they're also working already on the second step, which is to end the reason that these people are leaving their countries, which is, just to make things clear, it's not always war.
Right.
Actually, statistically, it's even, most of the time, it is not war. The reason for people leaving their country is not war. So, yeah, they are trying to bring back in the EU a little bit of common sense.
Yes. And we should all be grateful to the countries for that, because otherwise there wouldn't be anybody resisting this. But I think that's a good segue into Orban's speech in Transylvania this past Saturday. I mean, he's made a number of very good statements over the last 2 to 3 years about Europe in relation to immigration. But I really thought, after I read the text on your site, this was really sort of his crowning achievement so far. He really, I thought, articulated it better than any other statement I've read so far from him.
Yeah,
on this topic.
At least in Europe, yeah. The thing is, Viktor Orban is a strange character, actually. When he was 25 years old, he was the one asking for the Soviet troops to leave the country.
Mm-hmm.
He was, back in this time, part of the Soros networks.
Maybe what we would call like a liberal conservative.
Yes. Yeah, somehow. Yeah, yeah.
Like he talked in his speech, he says that, well, back then, we envisioned that we would be integrating Hungary into the EU. That was their original, and with the West,
generally. Yes, it's important to understand the state of mind of the people in this region back in this time. They had really few information. There were no internet back in this time.
Mm.
And try to imagine, if you don't have the TV and the newspapers speaking about what is happening elsewhere, or if they do, they do it only with a very strong bias, which is anti-Westerner.
Yes.
So, but still, they were able to get sometime from the radio or from friends traveling. They were able to get some idea of what could be the West. And also, they kept the cliché of the American dream, which were the clichés of before the Second World War. So for 45 years, people lived with this cliché.
Yes.
Plus some propaganda positive or negative about the West. And they made up some really, really biased and really weak image of what is the West. It was also something that appeared to be the land of freedom. And for people who were living under some level of oppression, it was really different from one country to another. It was not one monolithic block. But the thing is, for these people, it was hope. It was hope that Western one day will open its generous gates to us, and all the Eastern countries will be living happily the Western way of life with the same rights and the same freedom and...
two cars and a fancy house.
Yes, exactly. And everyone happy, TV, etc. Yeah.
Certainly Russia bought the Kool-Aid early on with the promise of liberal democracy and the capitalism and opening up markets. And they quickly learned that was a little too much.
Yeah, the Homo Sovieticus were the one becoming the quicker the Homo Economicus, because they are people who do not have any identity anymore, actually. If you do not have any identity, you are an easy prey for big companies or state. So Homo Sovieticus was a prey of the state, and Homo Economicus is a prey for big companies. But still, communism were not so destructive for identities than liberalism is. This is why in the beginning of the 90s, where the communism collapsed, you still have two different Europes, because the gap between the two Europes has not been resorbed. It's impossible, actually, but it would be really long to explain all the reasons. But to make it really simple, to keep it simple, at the fall of communism, when Europe became once again one entity, let's say, not speaking just about the EU, but all Europe fell under the rule of capitalism, you had people with identities, strong traditional identities here in Central Europe. I'm not saying that everyone and the people were not wearing anymore the traditional dress and they were not all going to the church and etc. But still, they still have some strong national feeling, for example, that in the same time in the West they had already lost. And this difference has not been resolved, because in Western countries now they are speaking about gay marriage, LGBT rights and all these things, when here they will be at the same level than 25 or 30 years before in the West. But meantime, they saw that this way actually is leading to the LGBT, the gay marriage, all these things that they do not want. Nobody wants it. I mean, 90% of the people do not want it. And so no, things are changing. Because people are understanding that this whole model, this whole regime, which is not just about economy, people are understanding liberalism is not just about economy. It's also linked with political, philosophical way of life and mindset. And they reject this. They do not really know how exactly right now, because there is, you know, some kind of inertia. And also the other thing is that it's never easy to revolt against someone who is much more stronger than you. Because let's face it, I mean, Central Europe for 500 years is weak. Until the 16th century, it was Poland and Hungary especially were real strong kingdoms. One of the strongest in the world back in this time. And in Europe, there were truly respected. Then they lost wars and they never recovered from the Hungarian, never recovered from the Ottoman invasion, and the Polish never recovered from the Russian and Prussian invasions. So it's a delicate situation for Central Europe, because even if it's many people, I mean, if you add up Baltic countries, the Visegrad countries and the Balkans, it's approximately 180 million people. It's huge. But these people are so different. There are almost as many languages than countries. And it's a lot of small states with a really complex history and complex cultures. In the Balkans, it's probably one of the most complex that I could talk about. Maybe we will talk a little bit about Bosnia. So it's really difficult to bring up one strong entity from all this. But this is why the Visegrad Group is really interesting. And this is one of the things that Viktor Orban said in his speech. According to him, in the past 12 months, the most important thing that happened on an international level is the strengthening of the Visegrad Group, which now is an entity recognized as such by China, Russia, Israel, Germany and France, and the USA. So it's something that people take seriously, everyone. And it happened really quickly. And this is something which will definitely have a big impact on the European policies and politics, at least for this first half of the century. It will really change things, and Orbán knows it. So just to get back to Orbán, he was part of the liberal conservatism, and he evolved. He was prime minister first time in 98 for 4 years. And at this time already, he disappointed the Soros network because he started to do many things for families, which is due to his Christian mindset. After that, we had 8 years of... They call themselves socialists, but they are not socialists. They are
neoliberal socialists.
Neoliberals, banksters, oligarchs.
Yes.
They are actually the... They were the last ones ruling the country under the communism. So, you know, all the oligarchs, all the people who organized the collapse of communism, because communism did not collapse just for economics and things like that. No, it collapsed because it has been planned that communism will collapse. And planned by the people who became rich after the fall of communism. These people organized it on more than 30 years. So these people, the so-called socialists, they ruled the country for 8 years. And during these 8 years, they really messed up the country. Hungary almost became bankrupt, and it was really difficult times. And during this time, Orbán were preparing his return, strengthening his camp. Also, the national radical camp in Hungary got really strong by opposition to this socialist post-communist elite. And that led to the return of Orbán to power in 2010.
Yes.
And from that time, he is ruling the country, so it's his technically it's his third mandate, no, and he will probably win next year, but who knows? In politics, 8 months is a lot.
Yes,
we know that. So Orbán has changed. He has learned from his mistakes. He understood the real agenda of his first friends, the one who stood behind him at the fall of communism. And I think many people in Hungary are criticizing Orbán, saying that he's corrupt or that he's leading the country towards some kind of authoritarian regime. I read an article in Hungarian a week ago, which was a really, really nice piece, a really interesting piece, basically saying that it's not about Orbán, it's about Hungary. That this country, actually, even at the fall of communism, the state itself has not changed that much, actually. Mm-hmm. And because of the size of the country, because of the culture of the country's elites, it works that way, which is not specifically due to Orbán. He might be using it, and he's strengthening his position because of this situation, but he's not the responsible people for the fact that the country, that Hungary, is kind of a typical post-Sovietic, little bit kind of oligarchical country. Hungary is not a country of democracy. Mm. But still, people like to express what they have to say. So people love freedom. Hungarian people love freedom, but they somehow, it's my opinion, but I think they despise responsibility and power, and they dislike it. Hungarian people are a little bit hedonistic. It's true that in Hungary, and you know, both of you know that you have everything to be happy. If you don't have any specific problem, you have everything to be happy. Hungarian love to enjoy things. And a little bit like the French people, too. They like to complain.
Well, Americans as well. But I just wanted to say, though, I mean, I would agree. I mean, of course, you know, things are great in Hungary. I think all of us who've come from outside see why we love living here. I mean, it's quite clear. But I also do understand that poverty in Hungary is still rampant. I mean, I think the average salary of a Hungarian is something like 400 euros a month.
Yeah, well, the thing is, Hungary is really, you have really big disparities in the country. Living in Budapest is not much different than living in any other big European Western cities, except that it's secure.
Yes.
So, but basically, the standard of life in Budapest is the same than in some middle-sized city in France, for example. In the countryside, it's really different. You have places where people are earning even more than in Budapest. For example, the people living near the Austrian border, many of them are working in Austria, so getting an Austrian salary, and then living with that in Hungary, which make some part of Hungary absolutely living on a Western level. other part of Hungary, especially in the eastern part, where you have also big problems with the integration of Gypsy community. You have people living really like in the third world. The people living without electricity, the roads are from dirt, no internet. So it's really a country where you find some of the poorest people in Europe, and also not the wealthiest, but at least people having...
with a Western standard.
With Western standard and living well. And the thing is, the poorest people usually do not vote also. So democratically speaking, they do not have a lot of weight. The other thing is that, for example, you have something which is a shock for many Hungarians. It's the fact that in Budapest especially, you might see a lot of hobos.
Yes.
And that's due to this capitalistic system, mm-hmm. for which the people older than 40 are not worthy to be hired, for example. It's more complicated, but I make it quick. And many people, for example, who are 50 or more, if they have some problem in life, like cancer or their partner died, they might get to the street. Yes. Because all the social system is a mess. And Hungary as a state, for now, is not really wealthy.
Yes.
Hungary is focusing on having a big GDP growth. For example, Hungary now for 2017, for this year, the prevision, it's between 4 and 5% of GDP growth. So it's huge, it's a lot. But it's also because you have part of the country or like schools or hospitals where it's worse than when it was communism. Because when it was communism, the state were taking care of such sectors and putting money in this. It was not on the Western standards, but it was working. And it is not the case anymore for some places. You have hospitals in Hungary which are Western standards, but most of them are not. Mm. So, especially in the countryside. So it's a complex situation. We are in a phase of transition. And I think that Orbán has this plan to, with this GDP growth, with this... with bringing a lot of big companies to Hungary with a very, very attractive financial policy. I think that I don't know in English what's the exact term, but like the tax and the benefits, something like that, you know? It's 9% for a company.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So it's even... Corporate tax. It's even lower than in Ireland, for example, which was usually set as an example. So in the same time, it's part of the Western world. Mm-hmm. But still, it's a country which is not so, I wouldn't say evolved because it's absurd, but which is not on the same level, industrially speaking, economically speaking. But still, people are very educated, speaking many languages. They're skilled workers mm-hmm. for quite cheap. And Orbán is using this to bring the Hungarian economy to a next level. We'll see if it works. It seems to bring some fruits, no?
I did appreciate the fact in the speech he just gave on Saturday, though, he did actually refer to GDP, and he said, well, this is how we measure the success of a country in the modern world. But, you know, of course, we know that that's...
There were some irony when he was speaking
about
that. Yes,
clearly. I mean, he was kind of mocking the Western European states, like, you're very successful, but...
Because I don't think you're living better in Belgium than in Hungary. I mean, usually... But GDP of Belgium is much more than Hungary. Mm-hmm. And even if people are, okay, let's say they have a better life in Belgium than Hungary, which I doubt, but take a look to the rate, let's say, between the happiness rate between Hungary and Belgium and GDP.
Yes.
So GDP is not all, definitely not all. It's like IQ, you know, you might not judge someone just based on his IQ.
Right.
Just one indication, that's all. It's not the people. The GDP is not the country. It's not how people... It's not giving you any information on how people are living, how happy they are. And more important, what future for the country.
Yes, when, as Greg is fond of saying before, like those who focus exclusively on economic factors, you know, he'll say, well, that means that in 20 or 30 years when... the Muslims come to political power in Europe, they'll have a really great economy to get started with if you only focus on economic factors.
Right. GDP and quality of life are two
absolutely
totally separate.
Absolutely.
And I also appreciated in Orban's speech when he said, you know, to those in Western Europe who were disagreeing with Hungary's policy, he said, well, I encourage you to think about this five times, because the average German worker makes five times what a Hungarian worker does.
And this is probably the most important thing that he has said. I mean, not from a philosophical or political point of view, but from what I would call the deep politics. Because until now, whole Central Europe is under the rule of Germany. Okay, most of the industry and the big companies in Central Europe are in the hand of German societies, yes. German companies. When Merkel calls Orban and when she tells him to buy 10,000 vehicles, he does it because he has no other choice, actually. Because if Germany is angry, then using the euro, I mean, Hungary is not in the eurozone, but the forint, the money of the currency of Hungary is linked to the euro. So it happened in 2012. Orban tried to make some changes and the Germany said no. And in 2 days, they made a 25% inflation for the foreign. So it was unsustainable for Hungary. Yes. So, okay, there is still a line that Hungary and the other Central European country cannot cross. It's speaking about NATO, for example, about Israel. For no, about the EU. It's not on the agenda to speak about the possibility to leave the EU. So EU, NATO, Israel are taboo. So, because you have to see Central Europe are vassals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but at home, they can, if they're popular and they have the support of the population, they can do pretty anything. But there are some things that they cannot change. It's about energy and some main geopolitical frame. This is why they also have to buy gas from different suppliers than Russia. This is why they cannot oppose NATO. This is really important. But no, it seems that Orban is getting closer to the red line. And we could say that in 2012 and 2011 also, he wanted to forbid the gay pride.
Mm-hmm.
And the American embassy said no. And we do not know the details, but there were no negotiations.
Huh.
So having a gay pride in the Western Bloc is an obligation. It's something which is essential. So in 2012, he tried to do some changes that changed the constitution at this time. And I forgot what I wanted to say.
Well, I was just going to mention, though, that the gay pride for this year yes. just happened in Budapest 2 weeks ago. And I noticed that they had to have a cordon of police. They blocked off all the roads.
Yeah, every year.
And
yes.
yeah, they. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that this is something that the Hungarian people really want when you have to have an army
Absolutely
of police.
Not. Absolutely not.
Keeping a distance of the of course, surrounding crowds
of
from
course.
The
Yeah, but
the
it's part of the agenda of yes. the leaders of the Western liberal bloc. So Orban tried to cross the red line in 2012. And he got quite strong warning. So I think back in this time, he tried not knowing where was the line. No, he knows. And when he is speaking about what is a key element of German power in Europe, which is Germany using the wage gap between Western countries and Central and Eastern countries. If for 25 years, salaries has almost not rose up, in Central and Eastern Europe, it's for a good reason. It's because it was one of the things that Germany was asking from this country. Basically, it happened this way. Fall of communism. Oligarchs take everything which was nationalized, they take it for them, and they sold it out to foreign buyers. German, French, Israeli, Russian, Italian, etc. And, for example, many factories, which were working quite good, they were bought, all the machines, machines were bought for the price just of the material. I mean, just not the price of the machine, but the price of the kilo, you know, mm-hmm. kilogram. So it was really a catastrophe. Everything which was working in Hungary just almost stopped, not just in Hungary, in all former Eastern Bloc. And everything has been sold to foreign companies, which basically bought the companies and closed the factories.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came to the country and said, I see you need industries, you need factories. So we will open a few factories in your country. So that will bring some work for you people, because now you have a huge unemployment. But in exchange, you keep low the salaries. And the fact that Orban, a few days ago, last week, talked about the fact that Germany is using this wage gap is really interesting, and I don't know which consequences it might have. And it might be huge, but he's doing it on purpose. No, he's knowing what he's doing. He knows that he is close to the red line, I would say. Also, it's interesting if you know a little bit Hungarian politics, interior politics, because the Jobbik, which is the main opposition party, which is a radical right-wing, or let's say populist party, it's one of their key proposals. It's they made up a petition. You have this European Citizens Initiative, which if you gather 1 million signatures in the European Union, you might ask the European Commission to make a statement. I mean, to they have to put it in their agenda to solve this question, to give an official answer, and eventually to make a law or take some decision related to this issue. And the Jobbik initiated such a project. And Orban was never, when they asked in the parliament, during the debates in the parliament, when they asked Orban, why are you not doing anything against the wage gap? He was just, not really answering. He was answering on different topics. And now he's speaking about it. So it might be also a tactic for the next election, because next year in Hungary, we'll have, in 2018, we'll have elections.
In April,
yeah. And this is also one topic that he seems to take from the Jobbik also. So it's also important to know this, to understand the context.
Well, that's why the presence of Jobbik in Hungarian politics over the last decade has been very crucial, because they're always pulling Fidesz further to the right.
Absolutely. The Jobbik has been formed in 2003, and it really gained popularity in 2006 during the riots against the socialist government. And actually, they revealed that the Hungarian society is asking for the protection of its identity and its freedoms. It's what the Jobbik is about. And the Jobbik is struggling now because Orban is more and more applying what the Jobbik proposed.
Well, I read in the 2010 election, Jobbik had a 10-point program that they said they would enact if they won. And I've read that subsequent to that, Fidesz has implemented 8 of the 10.
Yes. So you realize that it's really difficult for the Jobbik, because they had to evolve since the Fidesz did what they offered to do.
Yes.
So it's a difficult situation for them, but I don't know, it will be interesting for your auditors to know to speak about the Jobbik. But the thing is, most of the youth were and are supporter of the Jobbik.
Yes.
And I think the Fidesz and Orban understood that. He understood that he might go much more in a national conservative direction, because the youth will be on his side. The majority of youth will be on his side. And this is why the Fidesz made all this point the Jobbik was proposing. For example, also, it was not one of the points in 2010, but it was the Jobbik who asked first for the erection of the fence at the southern border. Mm-hmm. And the Fidesz did it. And it's really interesting, because if you know some local responsible people, you know that at the beginning, when the Jobbik was asking for the fence, many Fidesz people were, like deputies and local responsible, they were saying, we are doomed. We cannot do anything against this migration. It's the end, and we cannot face the EU on this topic, and it will be too difficult to build a fence. Mm-hmm. And then Orban understood it was a huge thing to do, and I think he changed many things in European politics by doing this fence and standing. Yes. Alone in the beginning, and then quickly supported by the Visegrad group. But he understood that this fence was a very good thing for him. And he did it, And no, he regained a lot of popularity for that.
Yeah, because I remember in 2015, there for 6 months or so, it really seemed like Jobbik had gained the momentum. You know, they won some local elections, and it seemed like they were poised to maybe pull ahead. And then the migrant crisis happened, and Orban really took the lead.
Absolutely.
And that very much took the momentum away from
Jobbik. Because in a country which is, let's say, at peace, where nothing serious happens, it's easy to bring back the government, to find the weak points, to criticize it, to break its image. But when there is a big crisis, the government alone is able to do something. And if they do it well, that's over. You cannot face a government which is successfully resolving a big crisis for the country. That's also really something really important to understand. And this is when also the Jobbik started to be more harsh in its criticism against Orban, make it more personal. And
like this advertising campaign that
ended
recently.
Exactly.
Well, it was banned, actually, by the government.
Yes,
right?
Not the government. They made a law.
Parliament. So our audience knows that just until 1 or 2 weeks ago on kiosk and billboard in Budapest. Well, there were two things. There was pictures of Orban and some of his closest associates. And was the message?
Basically, they were saying that they are stealing, you are working. And that was the first one. And then they made another one next to this one, after this one, saying that we will replace them.
Yes.
So the thing is, for the Jobbik, it's really difficult to propose new things. I mean, most of their ideas has been, we could say, stolen by the Fidesz. Mm. But they attack a lot of all the corruption things. It's another long topic. I think it could be for another time. This whole corruption thing in Central and Eastern Europe.
Yes.
It's not that easy that one might think. It's not that easy because corruption exists everywhere. It just has different forms. And if you take a look into who is leading the so-called anti-corruption fight, you understand that it's really specific political bias.
Mm. Well, I mean, I certainly, based on my time living in Hungary, I would never try to propose that Orban is perfect by any means, but...
No, he's a politician and he's a man. No man is perfect anyway.
But certainly, as even Orban himself pointed out in this address on Saturday, I mean, he sort of plays the same role for Hungary that Trump has been at least trying to do in the U.S., albeit much less successfully in the U.S.,
Yeah, even if Hungary is 35 times smaller than the U.S. and do not have the atomic bomb, nor...
Yeah, a little less powerful.
Yes, let's say. But we compensate with some cultural aspect. Yeah,
yes.
I will say.
Well, I do know from people I know on the inside that apparently when somebody mentioned the Hungarian border fence during the campaign, Trump... responded, Vic has the right idea. So he is aware, and of course that was one of the cornerstones of Trump's campaign, was this idea of a wall for immigration. Although I would say the big difference is that Orban is much more articulate than Trump. And of course more radical, although...
It's according to some European political culture also. I mean... No offense, but in the US, it's much more about the show, you know?
Oh, yes.
When in Europe, even if we can't complain about a loss of quality, but politicians usually still have some proper education, and they have also, the European background is so huge. It's so difficult to understand, to know, and it's bringing so many messages. I mean, just the 20th century for Europe has been such a trauma than for any European politician. They have to do with history.
Yes.
In there is not one single European politician who do not have the obligation to make some statement about historical things.
Yes.
So it's also one important thing. And, well, for a small country, it's also, you have different things to think about. I mean, for when you're leading a country of 10 million people, it's not the same than leading a country like the US.
Oh, of course not. And also, of course, the U.S. does not have a single ethnic or historical tradition.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a multicultural
and
society.
This is also why a European leader, especially someone like Orbán from a country small like Hungary, might have, with the same, using the same energy, he might have a much more deeper understanding of things of his country.
Yes.
Because if you have to take care of everything which is happening in the 10 million country or in a country like the US, it's not the same. You have to be more strategical with the US. While in Hungary, you might have also you might also do tactics.
Well, I would say the difference, though, is that in the US now, the system is basically rigged against anything truly right-wing. I mean, this very simple immigration ban that Trump wanted for six countries in the Middle East, he was unable to get through, let alone anything even more radical. So that's, of course, we can't blame Trump for that, but it just shows, you know, I think the U.S. is perhaps too far along the process of liberalization to undergo the kinds of reforms that Orbán is implementing, unfortunately. So.
Well, I guess you're right, but I don't really know about U.S. politics. I mean, I'm not an expert, but I get your point. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, another difference, of course, is that America is much more heterogeneous as a country. And as the president, you know, he has to represent Black Americans, Hispanic Americans. And
That's his people, too. He has to. Yeah. Otherwise, he could not lead the country anymore. I mean, there are many counter forces in the U.S. In the U.S. there are two big interests, different interests, to let someone do what he wants, if it's again his interest. In Hungary, for example, Hungary is a vassal of the EU, actually of Germany, to be more precise. So until nothing is done against the German interest, someone in Hungary might alone become powerful enough to do what he wants in the country. That's something important to understand also. This is why Orbán had been able to face all the national opposition, all the liberal opposition in the country.
Yes.
Because simply the country is small.
Yes.
Everyone knows everyone, I would say, in the politics milieu. And you don't have much strings to pull to make things happen. So it's also an important point to understand the differences.
Yes.
They're not playing on the same level, that's a fact. But the other fact is that they're playing, I would say, in harmony. And several times, say, Trump made references, he referred to Orbán, and Orbán did also to Trump, like in his last speech.
Didn't refer to him by name, but it was clear who he was talking about.
Well, he said Trump. He said,
I thought he only referred to the American president, but I mean, we all know who the president is.
Well, whatever, yes. The thing is, he quoted some part of Trump's first big international speech, I would say, which Obama made it in Cairo, but Trump made it in Warsaw.
Yes.
In Warsaw.
Yes.
And that's an important point that Orbán himself underlined. And the other thing, he quoted some sentences, and I think you can put the link of the full speech and the people can read it.
Mm-hmm.
He quoted some parts of Trump's speech, and he added that it was not possible for a Western leader to say that 2 years ago.
Yes.
Just 2 years ago. And we are clearly in a time of big changes in the Western, not only US, not only European, but in the whole Western world, and therefore everywhere on Earth also, because whatever we think about all this, but Western countries are the
driving force,
yes.
Yes.
For no. And the support of Trump for the Visegrad group is really interesting also. And maybe it's just a supposition, just a theory. Maybe I'm absolutely wrong, but for now, it's a possibility. Maybe the US now are looking to give less power to Germany, maybe even to bring slowly a dissolution of the EU. And in this operation, the Visegrad group might be an asset.
Yes.
From a Central European point of view, I would say that it's good to get rid from the EU, because I don't believe that we can change things within the EU. I don't think we can. There are too much lobbies, too much interest, and countries like France and Germany, they have too many representatives that are absolutely liberal, and we cannot change really the whole. It has, and the EU is really complex, and it has all its institutions have a really big inertia. So changing that, I don't think it's possible. So sooner or later, it might be possible that some country, including the Visegrad countries, might leave the EU. And maybe the USA is already getting, the USA is getting ready for that and already planning the next step, which will be new cooperation with new association of countries. Who knows? Who knows? Trump also is really glad to sell gas to Central European countries. So we'll see. We'll see, but maybe geopolitical changes might occur in Europe in the next decades.
Well, speaking of changes in Europe, we've spoken about Hungary quite a bit, but you also recently took a trip to Bosnia and you had some interesting experiences. Maybe you'd like to just say a few words about that.
Yeah. To understand, first of all, to understand the whole Central European and Balkan region, which is the heart of Europe. Yes. It's important to take a look at the map and see that all this region is stuck between in the middle of a triangle between three imperialistic powers, which are Germany, Russia, and Turkey. And all the past 500 years were about the struggle of all these countries between each other and for the domination over this, over the heart of Europe. And for the first time in half a millennium, Central Europe might be able to become one bloc, independent bloc, independent from Germany, Russia, and Turkey. But for now, let's speak about Bosnia, where Turkey is trying to get more influence. And everywhere in the Balkan, actually, Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, these countries are putting money into many projects, especially paying for mosques. But not only, because in Bosnia, when Indonesia, for example, gave 1 million euro to build a mosque, they built the mosque with 10% of this money, and with the rest, they built a school, a swimming pool, a library, and they kept also some of the money for themselves. But the thing is, most of the minarets you see in Bosnia, like approximately 80% of the minarets you see in Bosnia, are less than 20 years old.
Yes.
And Bosnia is a Muslim country, mostly Muslim country for the past 500 years since the Ottoman came to the country, the Turks. It's a really complex country because the country itself, the state itself, is really old. And actually, they were nor Catholic nor Orthodox. They were the Bogumil. It was a different kind of Christians, which was seen as heretics by Rome and by Constantinople. But the thing is, in order to survive, it's one of the theories that some secular Muslim explained me there. In order to survive from the Orthodox and the Catholic pressure, they became Muslim because they had a big power supporting them if they became Muslim. They became Muslim because it was not just about religion, they were also people. They were the Bosnian people. And because in Bosnia you also have Serbs and you also have Croats. And all these people, they constitute a federation of three ethnicities, and each of the ethnicity has its main religion. The Croats are Catholics, the Bosnians are Muslim, this is why we call them Bosniaks, and the Serbs are Orthodox. It's really a mess, and after the war, the Yugoslavian wars, the country became independent in the early 90s. The thing is, the UN stopped the war, but they imposed to stop the fight, but the war did not end.
Right.
So the thing is, there were no winner, no loser, and everyone is frustrated because every camp thinks that we might have more success if the war has not been ended by the UN.
Yes.
And many problems has not been solved. Many wounds are still open. And it's a really divided country. Three years ago, also, there were an attempt of coup d'etat. Mm-hmm. It failed. The thing is, traveling in the Balkan, speaking with Croats, Serbs, Bosniaks and others, they disagree on pretty everything, except one thing, that in the Balkans, and especially in Bosnia, it will be war in less than 10 years. Mm.
I think another important factor to mention, though, is that we could say that even though the Bosniaks have been Muslim for 500 years, it sort of evolved into, perhaps we could call it like a more Europeanized form of Islam.
Well, yeah.
But that's changing.
The thing is, for 500 years, they were, yes, as you say, more European, especially during the 20th century, like the Christian in Europe, they became more secular. Mm-hmm. And they were living in peace with Croats and Serbs without any problem due to ethnicity or religion. But with the Yugoslavian conflict, with each part of Yugoslavia trying to get its independence, nationalist...
Well, and also Salafist.
I will come to it. First of all, nationalism made a big rupture between... It bring the end of the cohesion between different ethnicities. And that was the first step. And then that was where it was an open door for Muslim political agenda.
Yeah, I mean,
to use the situation.
Years before most Americans had heard of Al-Qaeda, there were actually Al-Qaeda operatives fighting alongside
Bosnians. And if you go to Bosnia, you might, even in small villages in the mountains, you can meet someone with Pakistani or Afghan look because he is. Because there were Mujahideen going to Bosnia to fight a war with their Muslim brothers. And many of them stayed there. And they were actually used as agents by foreign powers like Saudi Arabia, Turkey and others to bring new imams, to bring money and to buy politicians, to buy economics, to buy real estate and to buy influence and trying to strengthen the Muslim community of Bosnia to link it with the rest of the Muslim world, while Bosnia was more European. And also it's linked with a plan in which the USA are involved, and we'll see if it's changed with Trump. I don't know. It's the so-called Green Belt. Mm-hmm. It will be... You have to take a map of the Balkan and see where is Bosnia. And then you have to see where is Kosovo, Albania, Macedonia, and Bulgaria. And in Turkey, people are Muslims. In Bulgaria, you have a Muslim minority. You have also Albanian Muslims in Macedonia, in Kosovo too. And then you have Bosnia. And if you link the dots, it makes like a belt, just in the cutting the Balkan in two. And this is something that would be really useful for Turkey, which wants to spread influence in the Balkan again. And for many reasons, it will be a bit long to explain it now, but for the USA, it's useful too. You have to know that in Kosovo and Montenegro, they have really huge NATO bases. From there, they can cover all the Eastern Mediterranean and part of the Black Sea. So it's huge. It's really important for the USA to have puppet government there.
Mm. Well, it'll be interesting to see how that evolves in the coming years.
Yeah, and this is why you also have Muslims going to Bosnia, which are, let's say, spin doctors, Salafist, Wahhabi, and they take some villages, they bring people there, who are, let's say, politically and religiously unquestionable for them. And they make little bases like that. The thing is, it's useful for many people. It's the irony of the thing. And when you speak with secular Bosniaks, they explain you that it's not a problem for many politicians, or it's a false problem. Because, for example, the Bosnian state a few years ago, they made a big police operation in one of these villages. And then they asked for EU funds. They say, yeah, you see, we have Salafists in our country. Yeah. We need support. It can be dangerous for Europe. We have to do something. Give us money. We have to buy weapons. We have to buy cars, etc. So it's good for them. It's good for the Muslim foreign powers because they are people they can rely on. They are basically agents. So it's useful for many aspects. And it's good also for the Croats and the Serbs because they can say, you see, we were right about Muslims. Mm-hmm. They are getting radicals and we will have to finish this war and take back this territory. So basically the only people who are in a bad situation because of the Salafists are the secular Muslims. And they are really scared about the very existence of Bosnia. And this is why they are pushing for Bosnia to join the European Union. I told them, but are you crazy? You see where it's leading people. Mm-hmm. And but they say, yeah, but we think it will collapse. But the time it will collapse will give us some time to avoid war. Mm-hmm. And that could be this time, maybe one generation could be enough to avoid war. And with one generation passing, maybe there will no reason left to make war. That's the point of view they gave me.
Are the secular, Europeanized Muslims a loud component of the
Middle East? Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty dark-skinned. I have several European origins, and I'm like a Mediterranean style. Yeah. Many people in Bosnia actually are more looking like both of you. Mm. And many blonde people, tall, blue-eyed people, they have this Slavic face, but they're not Arabic people. They're absolutely European people, ethnically speaking. And in their clothes, their way of living, they are absolutely European, except that they usually do not drink alcohol and do not eat pork. Right. But that's all.
Are the Salafists trying to impose Sharia law and such things?
No, absolutely not. They have a way, an organization which is really, it makes me think about the liberals. I went with some friends to some Salafist villages. When we went there, many people were very hostile. But then one guy came speaking better English than me, and he was very friendly, used to speak in front of a camera, and they have an old speech of, about peace. And, the guy was really obviously, he learned how to speak. He was a real spokesperson. So, and he has authority over the others who were naturally hostile to us because, we were strangers, obviously not Muslims and even not Salafists. So it was really, really interesting to experience that. Also, this typical, he was a politician, this guy. When we asked him, do you have ties with Saudi Arabia? Since we have seen in the village, we have seen a Saudi flag. We have recorded it. They say, no, you haven't seen that. The bigger it is, the easiest it is to pass a lie.
Yes.
A lie. So these guys are really organized. But I think they're not a real threat. I mean, they might be, but they're not a real threat. We are speaking about few villages that everyone knows where they are. I mean, every secret services knows everything about this guy. Many of them have fought in Middle East or are former, lost people who were on drugs and things like that, who were saved by religion and became, from one extreme to another. In one of these villages, I saw a guy with a long beard and this Arabic Salafist clothes. But the guy, he had, I don't know how many holes in his ear. Mm. He has tattoo. it was obvious that he was, before that, he was some kind of extremely liberal guy, So it's a sect, this Salafism. It works like a sect. And it's, as many sects, it's used by some intelligence services also.
Well, I think what we could say is that, it's probably unlikely that they could take over Bosnia. But still, this is a place. They're only a few hours from many of the capitals and many of the major cities of Europe. If a few people decided that, oh, you know, we need to strike back at the West. Yeah. They're in a very advantageous position.
But I think they're under control. And, you know, just to leave Bosnia with Scar from their villages, which are lost in the mountains, it's a lot. I mean, it's like two, three, four hours at least, even if Bosnia is a small country. So they're not people who disappear just like that. I think each one of them is permanently under control of several intelligence services. So as I say, I don't think they're a threat from this point of view. They're people who are not openly Salafist are bigger threat. You know, people living in the suburbs of Paris. It's one between millions of Arabic guy. If he does not even have the look of a Salafist,
right.
How do you want to think that his guy might take a truck and kill 80 people or a guy on drugs and 1 week later he's doing the Bataclan, you know?
Right.
So these guys are bigger threat, but this guy in the mountains in Bosnia, I don't think they're a threat, and I think they're a political tool.
Okay.
They are a political tool for several forces, as I explained it.
Yeah. Well, we should mention also there's a very interesting video that the Custodella organization, which is a Hungarian metapolitical immigration reform, or we could say anti-immigration organization here in Hungary. All the materials in English. It's Custodella. If you go on YouTube, you can find this. I don't remember the name of it, but there's a video about this situation in
Bosnia
that was just made this year. So I think we should include the link.
Yeah,
I would recommend that people go and check that out. But well, I think we've been talking for over an hour now.
I did have one final question about. I wanted to ask you what the fertility rate is like in Bosnia, and if there is a difference between the different groups, if one group is more fertile than another.
I don't know exactly. I should have checked before I came. The only thing I can say, it's not relevant. I mean, there is no big difference. Muslims do a little bit more children than Catholics and Orthodox, but it's not relevant. I mean, Bosnian are much more in a state of mind of European people, and also of Yugoslavian people. I mean, they are in a state of mind of post-war, post-communism, weak state. As I told you, many people fear the war again.
Yeah.
So in this, when you fear the war, you're not usually thinking about doing children.
Right?
Yeah. And also many young people move to Western countries like Austria, Switzerland, especially. And so that means that most of the young people who have a situation are not in the country, which make things more difficult to make families.
Well, before we wrap up, though, we probably should have done this at the beginning, but I did want to give our viewers some idea about your background. You are one quarter Hungarian?
Ethnically speaking, yes. I'm one quarter Hungarian and one eighth Serbian, one eighth Bavarian, one eighth Normand, one eighth Corsican, and one quarter Breton.
So you're
from French Brittany, of course.
Right, yes.
But so technically, I'm half French, half Hungarian. But I really consider myself as a European.
Yes.
And you know what's funny is that I'm patriotic. I have patriotic feelings. I love every culture. I love the real cultural diversity. I love to see differences when I travel.
Yes.
To meet with different people. But the irony is that I am absolutely part of this globalized 1% elite, let's say, because I'm speaking different languages. I have a high Western standard of living. I'm traveling a lot, meeting with many people. I know several cultures. I even have myself. I identify as Hungarian and French and Corsican.
Yeah, you're from France originally.
Yeah, I grew up. I was born in France. I grew up in France. Probably you hear it in my accent. But I'm living in Hungary for 7 years because. When I was 22, I was much more idealistic, I would say, and I couldn't bear to live in Paris anymore. I mean, It was too liberal, and I saw corruption in construction, on construction sites where I was working, and I wanted to do studies to be an engineer, but I was really, I was so shocked by what I saw, like the new kind of slavery of African people, and how they destroy the life of Polish workers, for example, with the asbest, you know, and things like that. And also how they take a lot of public money for themselves. Yeah. It's scary. I mean, the sum, when you hear about corruption in Hungary, it might be like, you know, you hear about a few million forints stolen. It's the same in France, but it's not in forints, it's in euro.
Yeah.
So, whatever. The thing is, I left everything. I had to have a new start. I was 22. I came to Hungary.
And you're a Hungarian citizen.
And I'm a Hungarian citizen since I'm born, because by blood I'm Hungarian. Mm-hmm. And my mother also teach me to speak, write, and read in Hungarian. Mm-hmm. And I was raised in both cultures. I was coming to Hungary each year, full months. I have family, friends from long time. So yeah, it was not a big change for me. I mean, I was not in a totally foreign country, mm-hmm. but still, it was a radical change of way of life. I had to find my place. It took me a few years. I also had to grow up to leave behind me some behavior and way of thinking, you know, of young people. I became an adult here, and I'm grateful for Hungary for everything it has given to me, which is basically the opportunity to believe in the future.
Mm. I think we can relate to that as well.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, was there anything else you wanted to...
No, that's all the... answer the questions that I have. So
I'm sorry for my bad English. It's my third language. So
I think it was fine. I think so. Yeah. It won't be any problem. I'll just mention too what you just said about it allows you to believe in the future again in Hungary. That's also how Orbán ended his speech. He said, "Well, maybe when I started in politics, we wanted to make Hungary like Europe, but now maybe, you know, we can actually make Europe more like Hungary."
Yeah. More specifically, he said that 27 years ago, we thought that our future is Europe.
Yes.
And now it seems that we are the future of Europe.
Yes, yes. That's more poetic.
Yeah.
I think that's something we all endorse.
Most definitely.
I do.
Well, thank you for your time, Ferenc. It's been
great. Thank you for the invitation. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Yeah.